Thanks for pressing play on the first ever Oz Media Report with me, Dan Barrett. This is a brand new podcast that's going to explore the intersection that exists between the media, technology, and culture. Each week, you can expect to hear conversations with media professionals and commentators who'll explore some of the broader issues the media is currently grappling with. Because this is the very first episode, you probably have some questions. First of all, there's already too many podcasts. Why does this one need to exist? Fair question. I felt there was a need for a podcast that took a broad look at the media in Australia. If you want a granular look at the media and its practitioners, there's great podcasts out there from industry publications like Media Week and Mumbrella. And then there's also the ABC's long-running TV show Media Watch. But I think there's bigger questions that need to be asked than those shows are built to do. For example, why is it that magazine titles that you have been reading for most of your life are all shutting down right now? Why are TV networks facing declining ad dollars? Why are people spending so much time looking at videos on TikTok don't have YouTube videos that they should be watching instead? Another question you probably have, Dan Barrett, who is this guy? Why does he sound so handsome? Look, I've been around for a while in a number of different types of roles. I was one of Australia's first podcasters with the long-running televised Revolution Pod. I spent a year as the deputy editor at the aforementioned Media Week. A couple of years over at SBS working with them on content marketing and producing podcasts. You may have heard me on Radio National. I was the TV critic on their RN Breakfast show for 2 years, and I was also a regular contributor to their defunct show, TV Club. These days, you can find me putting out a daily email newsletter about TV and screen culture at alwaysbewatching.com. There's also the TV review podcast I do in conjunction with that, also called Always Be Watching. Anyway, that's enough table setting. Let's get down to the business of the podcast this week. Probably the biggest question facing the media is, are we living in a post-fact world? Politicians, business people, commentators, they can broadcast the craziest of notions. In the past, they would have been shouted down, but in the modern era, say something with enough conviction and there'll be an element of the audience who believe it. These beliefs then get amplified through social media and reverberate back to simply become part of the discourse. For the majority of us who trade in common sense, it's maddening. Speaking for myself, I was already beyond frustrated with the way that things were going when suddenly QAnon cut through and became a household name. As if things weren't bad enough, now we have an online collective who are embracing a set of beliefs from anonymous people that they're hearing from on Reddit threads. This week, on the first ever Oz Media Report, we're going to find out more about QAnon. What exactly is QAnon? How is the media contributing to the spread of QAnon? And is it really something that we should be concerned about? In the second part of this week's podcast, we chat with former ABC radio presenter Spencer Howson. He spends his days as a tutor to up-and-coming radio professionals. What are these students expecting from an industry that has seen so many radio shows and stations shuttered in the recent months? QAnon has been such a pervasive presence in Australia that you can't ignore it. It's not fringe outliers anymore. Or is it? As I kick off the very first episode of the Oz Media Report, I wanted to get a better handle on the scope and even shape of QAnon. The person best equipped to provide some insight is Cameron Wilson. He's the internet reporter for Business Insider Australia and Gizmodo Australia, and has reported on QAnon extensively. Cam, thanks so much for joining me on the first episode. There's a lot riding on this, but no pressure.
Hi. what an honor. Thank you for having me.
Now, look, I am very excited to talk to you because I've been looking at QAnon and I've been scratching my head and obviously just had the standard state of derision that I think most people have. But increasingly, I'm getting really, really concerned about it. And before we dive in too far as to why I'm a bit freaked out by it, maybe there's people who don't quite understand what QAnon is just yet. So I thought maybe let's just start with the basics. What is QAnon and how did it start?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question and a tough one, and we'll get into why it's a bit of a tough one later. But, you know, essentially it is a conspiracy theory that has no evidence, I should start off by saying, that there is a secret cabal of satanic, perhaps cannibalistic, but certainly, you know, bad political elites, primarily in the US. And it's centered around this idea that Donald Trump is actually, you know, he's not like maybe as incompetent as he seems. What he actually is doing is he is in charge of this big investigation that's set to expose all these corrupt and evil people, and that'll happen at some point in the future. And it kind of comes from, I mean, the whole war comes out of there's a person or perhaps people who are anonymously posting on the internet, on different image boards, who claim to have the US's highest security ranking rating, so that they can kind of see all the top secret government information. And this one poster or posting account is putting out, you know, very regularly, you know, thousands now of little clues that essentially lay out the case that, you know, this whole quite absurd conspiracy theory is actually happening.
What's probably got me a bit freaked out by is that in my 40 years of life, and it's really hard saying that out loud, but in my 40 years of life, I've always looked at Australia as being a country that doesn't really suffer fools lightly, but it's taken a really strong foothold in Australia. So I guess maybe my question for you is, how has that happened? And is it necessarily taking as big a foothold as it seems, or is it really a perception issue from my end?
I mean, maybe first I'll just say is that this conspiracy theory is quite US-centric. Like, you know, like I said before, Donald Trump really is the key figure in all of this. A lot of the posts are supposedly about, you know, US politics and not really so much about other things. But, you know,
that's kind of why I'm a bit freaked out by the fact it's taken hold in Australia, because there's so much of this which is Trump-centric. And you look at the idea that supposedly this is an insider within Trump's close cabinet. So this Q figure that's apparently in charge of QAnon is a Trumpite, I guess, for want of a better phrase. So clearly it's within the Trump government. And so it's obviously going to have a strong US-centric nature to what's going on. But why in Australia are people necessarily jumping on board with this? Because everything about QAnon is USA QAnon. It doesn't seem like there's actually anything in Australia. Like, it's not like there's Q down under.
You know, it's very hard to say where QAnon beliefs begin and end. And that's how it's become Australian, because, you know, Australian believers and perhaps even international people who pay attention to Australian stuff have started to incorporate different aspects of Australia into this kind of conspiracy belief. So, for instance, we see there's this, you know, it's well known, and these really do exist. There are tunnels under Melbourne. But, you know, they've kind of brought in this, in fact, almost like transplanted this conspiracy, this aspect of it from New York, where they said, oh, there's child abuse happening in New York and it's happening in the tunnels underneath it. They said, well, the same thing's kind of happening in Melbourne as well. So you see people down here, people who engage with it, start to incorporate it into Australian, war. But I guess, like, just kind of the broader thing, and sorry to talk a little bit about this, but it also reflects the nature of our information, ecosystem now. I mean, many of us are really, really no longer tied to getting our information from primarily Australian sources. And if anything, you know, the culture wars, which is this idea that you've kind of got, you know, the kind of the cultural aspects of politics, which is, you know, fighting out over all kinds of things, that really, really, to me, based on my understanding of it, is quite international now. And so, for instance, you know, you see a lot of conservative people in Australia, or even people who may not necessarily vote for the coalition, but, you know, generally, you know, have strong allegiance to Donald Trump in Australia. And I guess, you know, in a way, this is just kind of an extension of this. You know, people no longer bound to paying attention to Australian news. They're also no longer bound to just paying attention to Australian conspiracy theories. And so that's why, you know, you've got all these people around Australia who are suddenly, you know, talking about Donald Trump, the president of a different country, as their kind of, you know, one true savior.
Yeah, baffling. So I look at the sort of broader idea of QAnon, and I look at the 5G conspiracies being brought in. I look at Bill Gates, who's controlling the COVID-19 vaccines, and it all seems to be tied in with QAnon. And I'm wondering, like, obviously this is conversations happening within US QAnon as well, but by the very nature that Australians are embracing this strong US idea and adapting it, just layering it over Australian culture and society, is it necessarily like a pure QAnon we have here, or is it maybe something else? And is it really just the idea of all conspiracies that appeal to the same types of contingent, the same cohort? Are they just kind of embracing all conspiracy life as QAnon now, rather than necessarily adhering to the doctrine of the messaging coming through the Reddit forums around QAnon and the Facebook QAnon pages?
Yeah, that's really tough one to say. I mean, my gut feeling is just that, like, there are Australian aspects of QAnon that people can kind of pay attention to here. But really, I don't think anyone, like, is essentially being drawn in through that so much as they're being drawn in through the American aspect, which many of us, you know quite well. And that's really getting them into that. I mean, for example, like, I mean, you know, most engaged people in Australia would have a pretty good sense of what's happening in US politics, because we all just can't but help pay attention to that. So, I mean, it's that same kind of thing. You know, if we're paying attention to their actual going on, you know, we're also kind of getting some of that other information through, which is that kind of conspiracy theory. So I guess, you know, do we have our own unique strain of it here? I mean, yes, in a way, but I think that, you know, many Australian QAnon believers, there'd be many of them who just wouldn't even pay attention to the Australian part of it. And I mean, you can go on to speculate why, I guess, US, I guess, you know, discourse and politics has kind of created an environment that's allowed a conspiracy theory like this to become rife. I mean, like, you know, the thing that I think has to have a big aspect in this, of course, I think would be the media ecosystem, where, you know, you've got, for instance, Fox News, which is, you know, way bigger than anything we have in Australia. You know, they've spent years and years now essentially trying to dehumanize, or at very least, like, paint, you know, the people who they oppose, which is the Democrats in politics, as, you know, not just like, you know, people who hold political beliefs they disagree with, but, you know, bad and evil people. You know, you're kind of planting the seeds for something like this to happen. And, you know, that kind of culture, although starts in the US, really, really, you know, it kind of, it's flowing out to the rest of the world. I mean, the other thing is, like, you know, I haven't mentioned this yet, but this is such a big part of it, which is that the social networks that we have now, the way that that allows us to access information, has made this kind of conspiracy belief possible. You know, it allows people to create communities of people who have similar, extremely fringe, absurd beliefs, but then to come together to encourage each other, to support each other, and to make them feel like it's a normal belief. You know, also there's this idea about the kind of the way that social media networks are set up to encourage engagement, and that often happens through quite strong and emotive, you know, ideas and reactions and kind of content. You know, that kind of stuff really has allowed, I guess, people to have, you know, I guess, be separate from that idea of, you know, it's an Australian conspiracy belief, it's an Australian idea, to being, I guess, part of this broader community that isn't just, you know, that isn't I guess, defined by its geological borders.
Now, is it mostly Facebook that's giving us a space in Australia? Because am I right in thinking this originally started as a Reddit idea, but it gained strength through Facebook? And it doesn't surprise me the idea it might take root in Facebook, purely because Facebook, and really what you were saying there, which is that Facebook's a space where you live your everyday life. You've got the pictures coming through of your friends and family. You've got people talking about their everyday lives. But then if you layer over this sort of fantastic idea of QAnon on top, it suddenly normalizes it, makes it feel like it's an everyday part of life. And so I'm wondering, does Facebook maybe give it that extra bit of strength that it maybe wouldn't if it was just purely a Reddit-focused conspiracy idea?
The person or people who are posting behind this account posted on anonymous image boards, which are 4chan and 8chan, but essentially these posts, which believers in QAnon call like breadcrumbs from Q, these are then taken from these quite extreme websites, because they're mostly unmoderated. You know, we kind of talk about, oh, Facebook and Twitter and all that needs more moderation. You know, these are largely like unmoderated and have a lot of gore, explicit material, the worst kinds of spoilers, that's all there. So these posts are made on there, but then they are just transplanted into other places. Like, there are websites which just essentially, they syndicate the content, one of which was recently, you know, the biggest one, which was taken down recently. And then it also gets onto Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these other social networks as well. And that's really the way in which it's become a bigger thing, because the truth is that your 6-year-old auntie who believes in QAnon in the US, which, by the way, the US tends to have a kind of different demographic for believers, tends to be older in the US, whereas in Australia it tends to be a bit younger, a bit more of the almost like alternative philosophy, like wellness kind of vibe. Anyway, you know, these websites and also these, like, you know, Facebook groups and pages and Instagram things, these are all the places that really have allowed you know, I guess, a wider accessibility to it. So Facebook has undeniably played a role in it. And something that we might kind of take for granted is that Facebook really does allow you, the whole point of it is to connect with people with similar ideas. And, you know, they really position that as an inherent good thing. But of course, in the space of like a fringe and dangerous belief, and I say dangerous because there are proponents of this belief who have allegedly committed crimes, including allegedly murder. Facebook allows you to be in communities with these people for other people to encourage you to, you know, give you affirmation and say that you're right in a way that never would have been possible before. I mean, look, it's just like caught as we say. If you were in, you know, a small town, Narrabri in Australia, you know, there's a couple of thousand people there, and you somehow came up with a belief that the Prime Minister was actually trying to expose a pedophile cabal, what's the chance you're going to find someone else who is going to sign on to this frankly ridiculous and unproven idea? Very little. But when you have something like Facebook, you kind of come up with an idea. Maybe if there's one other person in another town, you know, they join in with you. And if you can find enough people across the 3 billion Facebook users or Twitter and or other social network users, you could then kind of create these communities who essentially, in kind of the psychology of it, create what is called like an in-group. You know, they encourage each other. It becomes part of their identity. They really have facilitated this literally through that. And also to the way that their systems work. I mentioned before, the way that these networks are set up is they want to get people to react to things because that's what drives people staying on their platform longer. QAnon, as far as things go, is a pretty emotive thing. It's this idea that our children are being abused and potentially eaten by people who we think are evil. It doesn't get more engaging than that. In fact, you know, even if you disagree with it, it's quite engaging because you're like, this is absurd. So all of these networks, social networks, have a role to play, have played a role, I should say, and have some responsibility in this. And I guess to directly answer your question, you know, we kind of see, I mean, it's hard not to point the finger at Facebook, but that's because it is so big and it is, you know, it has 3 billion monthly users. So, you know, that's quite a lot. You have that big of anything, of course, you're going to get fringe kind of stuff comes out. But I mean, ultimately, it has been Facebook's decision to grow this large, to set up their ecosystem in a way that has allowed this to happen. So they do, as the biggest one, and they really do deserve some of the blame for allowing this problem to happen.
Yeah, I do feel that if you're going to be the town square of society, you actually have some responsibilities with that. Now, just thinking about the ridiculousness of some of the stories here, I'm thinking to a video I watched with a woman talking about how a QAnon member, QAnon believer at least, was talking about how she went down into these tunnels of presumably Melbourne, was finding all the bodies of babies, and she was talking about holding an arm or something. It was a few months ago I saw this, but I was watching it thinking it's completely ridiculous. I don't really understand who could buy into this, but the way the conversation was framed wasn't so much that it was necessarily about her voyage into the tunnels, but it sort of seemed like that was an incidental part of the conversation she was having with someone else online. And I looked at this and I thought, am I necessarily looking at QAnon the wrong way? Am I looking at QAnon through a serious lens where maybe all the people who are involved in QAnon are using this kind of like a sort of high stakes version, like cosplaying? It's like a fantasy world that they can kind of dip in and out of and aren't necessarily taking it anywhere near as seriously as I think they are. Is that possible? Or does the fact that they all tend to band together in rallies maybe suggest that this is actually something that is a strongly held belief?
No, I think, you're spot on with there in the idea that this is, you know, some people have kind of compared it to like a religion. But, you know, there's a school of thought, which is I've largely seen like put forward by the New York Times, Charlie Wardell and a few other people, that QAnon is almost more like one of those like alternate reality games where, I don't know if you've seen them, but you know, sometimes brands or I guess like people who are running games will essentially like, you know, put all these clues in real life. You know, they'll put something in a newspaper, they'll put something in a bus stop and to try and get you to solve a puzzle that's playing out in real life. This is in a way very similar because the whole point is that you get all these clues from this anonymous poster and I haven't like kind of explained it. And it's important to say they are cryptic to the point of being essentially incomprehensible. Also, I should say that they've time and time again made predictions that things are going to happen that haven't, you know, happened. Like, you know, I think like, you know, very early on it said Hillary Clinton is going to be arrested and then it never did. So like, you know, this poster doesn't have any credibility. But regardless, like, you know, the people who believe in it, who really get stuck into it, they see it as this kind of like active game to try and figure out almost like riddles and to try and incorporate into things that happen in the real world. So, you know, like the post will say, oh, like, you know, something will happen on this date and then this date comes along and then they'll try and figure out, look at all the events and then see what, you know, the leak is to this like hypothetical, you know, ring of elite pedophiles or whatever. So it becomes this activity where they, you know, it's not passive. It is very, very active. And that's why they spend, and that's how they can spend hours and hours a day kind of, you know, figuring out how, trying to make sense of the world through this. But as for whether it's serious, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are people who kind of say it almost as a bit of a laugh. But I guess, like, you know, you see people, I guess it's very hard to see maybe the fervor of a lot of these believers and think that this isn't something serious. Because at the end of the day, there have been conspiracy beliefs in the past. Think about the moon landing was faked and that kind of stuff. And, you know, even that is kind of, it's born in this idea of I have a distrust in authority. But the core real belief when you drill down into it, QAnon, is that the people who you disagree with politically or don't trust, they are evil and they are child abusers. And the whole idea is to, like, you know, as much as you can, like, almost literally demonize kind of people. And I think that people really, 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 like, honestly kind of believe that. And that's why it's quite serious. You know, even if it might seem kind of goofy, and even if, you know, they're kind of doing ridiculous things like posting all day or whatever, I guess I kind of question, you know, is it not extremely serious that essentially there's a growing part of the population who just really, really are kind of essentially detached from reality, but also, you know, strongly believe that people they don't agree with are like pretty much like subhuman.
So we've talked about digital platforms' role in this, so your Facebooks, your Reddits, and I guess maybe Twitter to an extent. But what about traditional media? Are they really playing a role in either perpetuating it or maybe not necessarily being active enough to talk the sort of broad, ridiculous ideas of QAnon down?
Yeah, so I'll split it into American and Australian. Something I haven't specifically addressed yet, but, you know, the size in America, roughly, you know, the best estimation is that I think it was in August, the NBC released a report that was leaked from Facebook that said they had done an internal investigation in July and found that there were 3 million members of QAnon groups on Facebook. And of course, there'd be some overlap in between that, but, you know, no matter the overlap, like, that, there's a significant amount of people.
So that isn't necessarily unique, so that could be like the broad, like, membership.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's, you know, there's probably people who not on Facebook, there's, you know, all around. But I mean, I think it is credible to say that there are potentially millions of Americans who believe in this, or at least are engaged in the content. In Australia, it's, I think, even proportionately, it remains quite niche. I looked up after Facebook and Twitter had announced initial crackdowns. And by crackdowns, I don't mean like getting rid of it, but they kind of said, we're getting rid of the worst parts of these communities who believe in this, but also have used that to harass other people and that kind of stuff. And I think I found a very, very, very brief investigation, you know, kind of groups and pages and accounts that had somewhere between, I think, up to about 70,000 followers in Australia. So even proportionally, it's quite small. So with that in mind, I mean, the US, it's a bigger problem. It's a significant, I think, factor in like local politics and national politics there. And you've kind of seen it, you know, you've seen parts of the media really draw attention to this early on. And you know, they, like, American media were obviously the first on the story. There's been some really, really great coverage done by it. And I think generally I've been largely impressed to the extent that at least now you'd say that most major media outlets are taking this seriously. Like, they don't just think it's people, you know, just playing around it and not having any effect on the world. They really, really are, you know, considering it a kind of a real potential hazard. But you have seen definitely certain parts of the media, I guess, be fooled by aspects of it. And by that, I mean, a kind of offshoot of QAnon has been this kind of campaign called Save the Children, which was, you know, essentially there have been some believers of QAnon who have kind of, I guess, almost created a more like whitewashed, toned down version of it that takes away the most, I guess, ridiculous and absurd theories and focuses on this idea of we need to stop child sex trafficking that's happening in the US. And they've run rallies and stuff, but, you know, ultimately it really, really is linked in with these absurd beliefs. And I should also note as well that, you know, they're not actually trying to help child sex trafficking charities or anything. Like, they're not trying to help anyone who's actually fighting it. They're essentially like, it's kind of almost become a bit of a recruitment tool for believers into this. You've seen local media be fooled by this, you know, cover the Save Our Children rally as if it is a serious, genuine attempt to actually engage with this problem and not actually kind of like essentially a conspiracy theory. So you've seen some people be fooled. And also I think you've, you know, generally seen, you know, some media outlets do kind of, I guess, kind of things that I would consider bad etiquette around it, which is things like, you know, doing everything they can to contextualize it and say, you know, that although this is a conspiracy belief that might sound crazy, you know, that it is quite, it, here's all the damage that it does to people. Like, these are the families who've kind of been torn apart by this, etc. And you know, in their discussing of the conspiracy theory, making sure that they don't just, like, I guess, share the beliefs without contextualizing that it is absurd, there's no proof, blah, blah, blah. You know, it is essentially a discredited theory. In Australia, you haven't seen as much media coverage, although I think it is kind of picking up. But again, it's a small problem here. And so I think because of that, you know, that there hasn't been as much general media coverage of it. Australia, I think generally in terms of how it covers fringe and conspiracy theories, still lags behind the US. But I think also, to be honest, the problems still probably lag behind the US as well.
Yeah, in Australia, we don't really have any sort of QAnon leaders. So, like, Pete Evans might be the front runner. Would that be about right?
Yeah. And that's something that I've noted that, like, you know, in the US, there really is, an embrace of this theory from people who are relevant to politics. You know, there is, General Flynn, Michael Flynn, who, you know, used to serve in the White House. He's, like, fully embraced. I don't actually think he's a believer, but I think he's kind of been incorporated by this anonymous Q poster, and he's kind of embraced it, and essentially he's using it, you know, as his own, you know, for his own benefit. I think he trying to, you know, get support for whatever he's doing. But then there are, you know, there's people who literally will be, you know, they are the candidates for Congress, and they are in safe areas, so they will get elected for Congress, who are QAnon believers and real, like, it really seems like true believers. So you've seen this in the US. You haven't really seen that in Australia. You know, you mentioned Pete Evans before. I would say he would be the biggest name that has, I guess, publicly shared content that promotes QAnon. I've heard whispers. I haven't actually told anyone this, so this is kind of breaking. I've heard whispers of sitting politicians who have embraced this kind of content, but haven't seen any proof so far. But still generally, you know, you really have not seen, you know, even really almost, there's only one even, I think, fringe political figure who ran in a by-election who I know has kind of, actively espoused these beliefs. And, you know, he didn't go very far. So we still haven't really seen any real embrace of it from anyone who's relevant to politics here.
Yeah, I guess maybe let's just maybe wind things out. The tension I'm seeing at the moment is we've got the US election, which is, as we record this, I think 47 days away. Tension is obviously ratcheting up quite dramatically in the US, and you can just kind of feel it. It's very palpable. As QAnon gets closer to the election, does it necessarily amp up in the same way? And will that be released once maybe Donald Trump doesn't win? Or counter that, if Donald Trump wins, does QAnon suddenly find some greater stability and continue on to maybe amplify its messaging?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I honestly have no idea. This is probably a dangerous business to be making predictions in, because, I mean, it really is, you know, at least, you know, I'm 29, so I'm not that old, but I've really never seen anything like this before. And, you know, like I said, the way that these are amplified and enabled by social networks is something we've never seen before. So I really, you know, think it's something that is as much as possible without precedent. I mean, yeah, I think things will continue to ramp up until the election, because obviously, like I said before, there is a portion of the American population who think that the person who is at this point, you know, a pretty safe bet to win the White House, you know, they think that he is part of this kind of crew of evil pedophiles. So I imagine that is going to kind of continue to become more and more tense as the election approaches, and the possibility becomes more and more clear that and more likely that you know, the election, that the person who's going to be elected isn't going to be Donald Trump. And then I guess, you know, to some extent, it really depends on how Trump and the rest of I guess the leaders of US politics react to it. We saw Donald Trump, you know, he was asked about it in a press briefing, I think 2 weeks ago. And he, you know, essentially did everything that he could to stoke it by saying that, well, like, you know, if they say they're trying to catch, you know, child predators, isn't that a good thing? And he you know, did not say that, you know, I do not believe this is absurd. you know, maybe he embraces it more and more as the election goes forward. Maybe after the election, he just, you know, when the safeguards are off, he just really, like, you know, goes into it and tries to, I guess, lean into it as much as he can. I don't really know. I think the other thing to consider is, like, I mean, we haven't touched on this much, but, you know, there's a bit of reporting that essentially suggests that the people who are behind Q now, that kind of anonymous poster, may be, you know, again, different kind of people. And essentially, it's people making money off it. So, you know, if you think about what they are interested in, they're going to figure out a way, I imagine, to try and keep it going, even after this year's election is over. So, look, I don't think it's going anywhere. How will people who so vehemently believe that essentially that the current president is their savior, how they will react to him potentially losing, as is looking increasingly likely? I don't really know. It doesn't sound like a good thing. But I guess let's just kind of hope that people, the more we understand it, the more that people can engage with people who believe with it and try and as much, I guess, more than to reality. Because at the end of the day, this is, it's really sad. There are people who become detached from their families, who lose their jobs, who go into commit crimes all in the belief of something that isn't true. You know, ultimately what we can do to try and help these people, I guess, you know, bring them back into the fold and make them feel, you know, trust in institutions and authorities again. Everything we can do would be helpful. So I think we should all be, like, thinking about that.
I guess as the saying goes, may you live in increasingly absurd times. Cam, thanks so much. I'm not sure I'm any less freaked out than I was beforehand, but at least I've got a little bit more context to work with.
No worries. Yeah, it's a scary time, but hey, look, I think it's better to know than not know.
For 11 years, Spencer Howson was the host of the ABC Breakfast Show in Brisbane. He was number one in the ratings for a pretty good chunk of that. As far as Brisbane media goes, Spencer was a pretty big deal and remains so, even if he hasn't exactly been on the air as much anymore. These days, he's keeping pretty busy working a couple of smaller gigs. He does a little bit of off-air work for ABC Radio. He's involved with the community radio station Reading Radio, and he's been actively supporting the next generation of radio talent as a tutor at USQ Springfield. Spencer, thanks for joining me on the very first Oz Media Report.
It's an honour and a pleasure, Dan.
Now, Spencer, I know you're going to rip into me in just a moment. 11 years, that's not quite right, is it?
Well, it was 11 the second time around, so, you know, it's kind of correct, but I did 4 years on Breakfast prior to that, so I generally tack the two together because I think it looks better to say 15 years. Am I wrong? Should I just go with the 11 years?
Well, here's my dilemma with it, which is that I only got to know you from being an afternoon radio host, which you did in the middle of those two stints on Breakfast. So as far as I'm concerned, you're an afternoon host and then a breakfast host, and you never existed before then.
Fine by me. But it was 15 years, but that's fine. Yeah.
Were you number one for the most part in that four-year stint prior?
No.
Then I wouldn't never. Talk. I wouldn't talk about it.
The ratings were appalling in those first 4 years. But I started doing Breakfast when I was 24. So, you know, when I came back the second time round as a 34-year-old, I was far more successful.
Okay, look, I am incredibly interested with your current work. Not your previous work. I've got no interest there whatsoever. However, I'm really fascinated by the work you're doing at the moment with the students at USQ Springfield, because it strikes me as a very precarious time in the world to pursue a career in the media, particularly in an industry where, like, the radio industry is unquestionably scaling down right now. Let's start with the training. Give us an idea about the curriculum that you've got running at USQ, and how's it different to what you might have been doing if you started the course, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
Okay, perfect timing for that question, Dan, because the course did start 10 years ago, and we are rejigging it as we speak, and the brand new course starts in semester one next year. So anyone enrolling right now will be enrolling in a different course to the one that the current students are in.
So how's it different?
The difference is that two things, I suppose. One is that, which is potentially slightly less interesting and less to your point, but up until now, it's been Bachelor of Creative Arts and then majoring in radio. That's what the radio audio students have done. But under the new degree, there is a separate Bachelor of Television and Radio Production. So we don't come under, it comes under Creative Arts School, but it's not a Bachelor of Creative Arts. And the difference then is it enables us to have far more audio specific subjects. So the students who are currently going through the course do, in first year, they don't do radio. In second year, they do a radio course in semester one, then a radio course in semester two. And in third year, they can choose to do a project that is maybe around radio. And then they do a course called Major Broadcast, which is a bit of TV and a bit of radio. But under the new degree, they're going to be doing a radio management course, a podcasting subject, a radio promotions and integration, like brand integration course, as well as the basic radio, the advanced radio, audio editing one, audio editing two. So it's far more specialized and in depth around audio, but the students can also still take a bit of TV, a bit of film, a bit of some of those other things as well.
So is the emphasis then on radio still, or is it on audio broadly?
Audio.
Like, how is it being framed in a conversation with the kids?
Well, in actual fact, it compared to the current course, it's more of both, because we're doing, I mean, and there's a subject which is delivery platforms, and that's going to go to TV streaming as well as podcasting. So at the end of the new degree, the students are going to know a lot more about audio production, and also a lot more about radio and radio stations. It's just a much, you know, we've refined it, and it's a much better offering than what we've had before. But I suppose, to your point, it's far more recognizing audio as the product rather than something coming from a transmitter that, you know, that was AM, FM radio.
So with young people, and I'm thinking about your course being primarily for young people, but of course there are like adults who come later in life to do these courses. People who've grown up with radio as less and less a part of their lives, are they coming to it with the idea of becoming radio professionals, or are they thinking more broadly in terms of what the courses are actually offering, which is that it's an offline audio production course more than necessarily a radio broadcasting course?
Yeah, so we're a little bit odd in our place in the University of Southern Queensland, because your average student at USQ is in their 30s and studying online. And that's people who are doing education and nursing, et cetera, all the other courses. But those who are doing the media courses are typically straight out of school, and they are typically on campus. So yes, we are talking about 18, 19 year olds who start the course. Have they grown up listening to radio? No. Are they particularly interested in being a radio presenter? No, to be honest. Like, this is my experience so far. Now that we've got to have this Bachelor of Television and Radio Production, I'm expecting that we're going to actually attract students who know they want to work in radio or TV. But up until this point, it's been, I think you'd say, probably students who did film and television at school, or media studies at school, and enjoyed that and sort of rolled into uni, not quite sure what they wanted to do. And to be honest, when I first get them at the beginning of second year and I say, okay, who listens to radio? I have seen in the 4 years that I've been there, that's gone from maybe a third of the class, or let's say just under half the class, saying, yes, we love listening to HIT, or we love listening to Triple J. This year, I think I had 12 students in that class, and one was a radio listener. And the rest, most of the rest, listened to podcasts, not radio, not traditional radio.
That is incredible. So obviously there's still jobs in radio. Regional radio offered a really good on-the-job training for professionals ahead of a move into metro markets. Now, those opportunities, particularly now this year with the extreme scaling down that we've seen sort of as a result of COVID, the opportunities are far and few between to be able to get those roles. What sort of professional training opportunities are there once you finish being able to mold the next minds?
Well, what I think is happening is that just as the number of students or 19, 20-year-olds being interested in radio is declining, because they're not listening to radio, at the same time, the number of actual radio presenter jobs is declining as well. And I actually think the two are staying pretty well in balance. In my ABC role, which is program quality advisor, it's a 2-day-a-week role, and it involves sort of talent spotting, talent development, air checking of ABC presenters. I'm involved on job panels. And we have 44 regional ABC radio stations across the country, and there is a shortage of good radio presenter talent out there. To put it another way, and this might have been a little bit nerdy anywhere else in the podverse, but
not on this podcast.
The Bureau of Statistics, the last census, which I know was 4 years ago, showed that in Australia there are 1,500 radio presenters. Now, we know there have been big changes in the last 4 years. So let's say that there are 1,000. Let's remove a third of radio presenters in the last 4 years and guess, we won't know till the census next year. Let's say there are 1,000 radio presenters in Australia. Let's say that a radio presenter has a 30-year career in radio, which most won't. Most actually will get bored before then, or they'll realize they're no good at it and leave and do something else. But let's assume. So even if they all have 30 years in radio, we need to, Australia needs to find 33.333 new radio presenters every year. Where are they coming from? There is actually a shortage. Now, I know those numbers might seem minuscule if you're someone who's involved with recruiting for McDonald's or Coles, where you deal with thousands of staff, but there is actually a shortage of good talent and good radio presenter talent in this country. So my students are not all going to end up, that's just presenters, by the way. I mean, there are radio producer jobs as well all over the country, and that's another thing. No one really ever talks about being a radio producer as a career. So there's a shortage of people keen to be good radio producers, and you can't have a good radio show without a good radio producer. So, you know, I think that for my students, what we want to do now is introduce to them the idea that there's this thing called radio presenting, there's this thing called radio producing, but also get them to pick up as many skills around audio and storytelling as they can for the 3 years that I've got them. Because there are opportunities out there that are not radio presenting. And I'll give you one example really quickly. I was at the Sit Down Comedy Club in Brisbane a couple of weeks ago during the day, having a look at the venue because we're going to do an outside broadcast there at the end of October. So my TV students are going to broadcast a comedy night. And during COVID, Fideli Krishi, who runs the Sit Down Comedy Club, has installed two podcasting spaces, one which has seating for 100 and one which is a soundproof studio. Because he sees the demand for that in Brisbane, having podcast spaces. And some of it will involve the comedians that come to his club and others won't be comedians. They'll just hire the space. Crime podcast with a live audience, for example. And he said to me, I'm going to need people who've got audio skills to run this stuff. And I'm really excited your students are coming and doing the outside broadcast because I get to have a look at them because they're probably the people I'm going to need to hire to run the podcasting studio.
Okay, so I'm thinking about a conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago, and you mentioned the change in mindset amongst the students. So they're not interested as much in local radio in the way that the way that maybe you were when you came up. You're Mr. Local Radio. You made a very good career, really tapping into what I don't think other people in the market were at the time, which is why you were so successful ratings-wise, which is that you understood local and you were able to apply that to your radio program. But you've got this large batch of students who are entering the space now who aren't interested in local and they're listening to podcasts which have much more of a global focus. And I'm wondering, are your students missing out on something by not having that interest in local, or is this maybe just that part of the changing nature of media?
We tried something new this semester with our third year students, and something that you were very generously involved with, Dan, which was I saw that the students had this global view of the world, and they still do. When the stuff that interests my students, my 19, 20, 21-year-old students, is QAnon and Trump and global warming, you know, climate change, big time, by the way, you know, big time. If there's some free market research for anyone who can find that useful. They're really passionate about it, but not so much about clearing some land to build a new shopping center in Ipswich or what. I just made that up off the top of my head. So this semester, I got them to make what I described to them as an ABC style radio show. So talk song, interview song, interview song, interview song, interview song, that sort of thing. And I said, the content has to be local. We had one exception, which was this fantastic streaming and podcast reviewer. You might know by the name of Dan Barrett.
Really charming guy. And he's got a lot of interesting things to say. He doesn't have enough platforms to say it all.
It was very funny. And he didn't, it wasn't like any of the weeks he forgotten and had to do it live from a shopping center. That really, really good committed guy.
Shopping center car park, but go on.
So the point of that was to introduce them to the idea of a regular guest as well that you deal with on a weekly basis. But it actually proved to me that it was possible to get them engaged with local. It's just that no one's tried before. So they're not listening to local radio. So then, and maybe mum and dad are not watching the 6 p.m. news. But when I said to them, no, this is a show for Ipswich and Springfield, all of a sudden, or within a couple of weeks, they were, as a group of six students, they were knocking each other's ideas down, saying, no, that's not local. That's not local. Oh, that's a good. And we ended up doing a local radio show. And at the end of it, they had a ball. And a couple of the students said, this is the best thing we've done in the 3 years here. So suddenly I'm enthused again. They just, there's no one else, I think, in their lives, though, showing them, you know, what it is to be interested locally. But the problem, of course, is I can do that. That's really small scale, me and six teenagers or six 20-year-olds, and suddenly we've got six people who are excited in local, but their generation is not. So why is their generation going to be interested in local radio and local media? Because I can't sit down with every single one of them and tell them how interesting local is. So that does concern me.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm thinking there's obviously going to be a bit of a shift in their consumption habits as well, where people always make the mistake of saying, oh, this is what the future of insert name of media is here, because my 16-year-old kid isn't really interested in that. But people go through various life changes. So, for example, they may not necessarily be interested in local content right now, but when they're sitting in a car 5 years from now where they're commuting to and from work, maybe actually hearing the local traffic might be more of an issue for them. And I appreciate that 5 years from now, local traffic may not necessarily be delivered in a AM radio sort of talkback in that way. It might be something that's actually delivered by their Spotify or whatever. But in theory, a lot of the benefits that come from local are actually things which they may just not necessarily be interested in at this point.
I hope so, but I'll confess to you that in the 4 years since I finished up on ABC Brisbane, I have paid far less attention to the news, to local news, and I don't feel I need to have a local radio station on to give me traffic, because even if I'm just driving from my house at Indooroopilly to the campus at Springfield, which is a 20-minute drive, I will put Apple Maps on just because of that one day where there's a crash and it redirects me off at Mount Ominy. I don't need the radio to tell me that. And I don't actually feel that, and I'm slowing down because, you know, this is a big thing for me to admit, but I don't actually feel that I'm missing out on as much as I probably, you know, I was so, as you say, so much about local radio and Brisbane and everything that's going on in Brisbane. I couldn't name half the councillors in Brisbane City Council now. And I suspect that makes me more normal than I once was. But does it make me less of a person that I'm not interested? On the other hand, I would always argue that if you're not interested in local, that's problematic for the pride of an entire community, and an entire community can break down if people are not proud of their community, and the extreme of that would see us not caring about developments, not caring about vandalism, and not caring about, you know, things that are going on just outside the window a little bit. So in theory, I would like to think that people take an interest in local. I'm not convinced that my students, when they get to 25 and they're stuck in traffic on the way to work, will automatically be interested in local. No, I think they're going to remain interested in global.
Yeah, the global warming podcasts and wrestling podcasts and whatever else they might be listening to.
Wrestling podcasts, sure. But yes, that's what I think. And so, you know, do radio stations need to remain local if that's the case? And ultimately, that's the question that is now facing radio around the world. And it started before COVID. COVID has certainly added to it, this reduction of local radio around the place. And the question is, you know, if a show can be networked and can rate just as well or be number two or number three in the market, is that a bad thing? You know, from the radio station's point of view and the listener's point of view, plenty of, you know, the biggest shows in this country, you know, I guess apart from a couple of obvious breakfast shows in Sydney, are the national drive programs now. I mean, they're the shows. That's where the big names are. They're not local at all. And I mean, because the thing is, we do also need people who are not just 20 entering. This is the thing, like the future of radio is actually targeting 40 plus, which everyone is saying. Hit's just changed to that. Nine's saying that. And so can a 20-year-old presenter actually be the future of radio for the next 20 years? We actually need some 40-year-old career changers to come into radio.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking at making a pivot soon. Spencer Howson, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Can I come back next week?
Thanks for joining me for the first ever Oz Media Report podcast. I plan to be back next week with some more interesting conversations. Huge thanks to this week's guest, journalist Cameron Wilson, and also to Queensland radio legend Spencer Howson. If you enjoyed this podcast, please talk it up in your social media channels. Also, if you can leave a review, that would mean a lot to the ongoing success of this podcast. You can find me on Twitter at the Dan Barrett, And you can also email me, dan@ozmedia.report. Thank you for supporting independent media. Let's chat again next week.